This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we will talk about the current fighting involving Israel and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. It is now going into its fourth week. Back in the middle of last month, around middle July, July 12th to be precise, Hezbollah guerrillas crossed into Israel from Lebanon and they captured two Israeli soldiers. In response, Israel launched airstrikes against Hezbollah positions and also sent troops into southern Lebanon for the first time since 2000. Hezbollah responded with rocket attacks, and now that fighting has continued, as I said, for more than 3 weeks. It is a complicated situation because not only does it involve Israel, Hezbollah, and Lebanon, but it involves neighboring countries as well. It ties up the entire region. And we'll try and see if we can sort some of this out this morning as we talk with David Lesh. He is a professor of Middle East history in the Department of History at Trinity University, which is in San Antonio, Texas. He is also coordinator of the Middle East concentration in the International Studies program there. He has authored a number of books about Syria and also about United States policy in the Middle East. You may recall he talked with us not very long ago about his most recent book, The New Lion of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. And that book was published by the Yale University Press and came out last year. He's authored a number of others. Questions, of course, are welcome as we move through the hour. The only thing we ask of people who are listening is that people just try to be brief in their comments. And we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, we definitely want to involve people who are listening in the program. If you'd like to call, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Professor Lesh, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing great.
Well, thanks once again for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Perhaps as a very general question to start out with, I think, certainly my understanding that this the stage, I think, had been set for this battle between Israel and Hezbollah for some time. Certainly, the leadership of Hezbollah, I think, was preparing for this, had been preparing for something like this. And it's also my understanding that the Israeli government, Israeli military, had a kind of a plan that was ready and that was simply sitting on the shelf, that all they needed to do was say the word to go and it would be implemented. So having said that, though, why now? Why is this happening now?
Well, I think systemically, and a general reason, is it really, in my opinion, as a result of the failure of American policy right now vis-a-vis Iraq and the perceived weakness of American policy and its illegitimacy, again, largely from the quagmire we've involved ourselves in Iraq, that has allowed state and sub-state actors to assert themselves. I mean, I don't think this would have happened a couple of years ago, even a couple of years ago, when the insurgency was in its infancy in Iraq and the U.S. was riding much higher than it is right now, and when the Bush administration was really pushing its democracy agenda and making some inroads in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and other countries. But the perception in the region, and having a couple weeks ago just been in Syria, the perception in the region is that the United States is ensconced in Iraq, is focused on what's going on in Iran, has been aloof regarding the Arab-Israeli arena. Some state, sub-state actors, such as Hezbollah and such as Hamas, have asserted themselves to try to reach their own objectives in their own particular arena. And with Hezbollah, they've been under threat ever since the passage of UN Security Council Resolution 1559 in the fall of 2004. That one of the things it calls for is disarming militias, i.e. Hezbollah. And with the Syrians withdrawing in spring 2005, their position, they felt, was being threatened by, American-supported government in Lebanon, and they saw the crisis with Israel and the Hamas in the territories and the taking of the Israeli soldier, I believe, as an opportunity to exert their local influence in Lebanon, to reinforce the fact that there is still a struggle with Israel, that Hezbollah is the only group in Lebanon, sect in Lebanon, militia in Lebanon, capable of carrying on this struggle with Israel. And to a large extent, as long as they survive this Israeli onslaught, I think politically they've enhanced their position in Lebanon.
Well, is that then, as far as Hezbollah is concerned, that's their ultimate goal here, that is to solidify and perhaps to enhance their base there in Lebanon?
Yeah, I believe so. Again, because they really felt that after the Syrians left last year, with after the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafi Hariri, a kind of a Sunni Christian and Druze alliance started to develop in the government in Lebanon. That I think Hezbollah saw in cahoots with France and the United States, trying to squeeze Hezbollah. And as long as there is this, perceived struggle with Israel, and certainly as long as 40-45% of the population is Shiite, you really can't ignore Hezbollah, and they certainly do not want to disarm. So, they could come out of this in a way that redirects the Lebanese political environment more, not toward the establishment of an Islamic Republic of Lebanon. I don't think that's in their interests or is doable in the foreseeable future, but to just enhance their political position and their permanency in the government.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that I think is raised and has been raised by a lot of people looking at this situation is, is there anyone here who has some kind of leverage with Hezbollah, that if you were going to try to persuade them to back off, who would it be? And it seems that the main candidate always is Syria, and mm-hmm. that there is a suggestion that somehow Syria has enough influence over Hezbollah so that if President Assad wanted to, he could, in a manner of speaking, get on the telephone and call the leader of Hezbollah and say, look, can't you just settle down here. It does, in fact, the government of Syria have anything like that kind of influence with Hezbollah?
Yeah, they have influence with Hezbollah, but I don't think that level of influence anymore, especially since there are no longer, 20 to 30,000 Syrian troops in Lebanon that can enforce that influence. In the past, in the, Bashar's father, in the 1980s and 1990s, when there was a situation regarding Hezbollah in terms of captives or whatever, there were several instances where his father did get on the phone and threatened to do this, that, and the other thing, and all of a sudden, the hostage was released or this situation was mollified, whatever. But without those troops there, Syria does not have as much influence. Hezbollah is more independent, in my opinion, than most people think. And frankly, I think Iran is the senior partner and Syria the junior partner in terms of influence over Hezbollah, with Iran, with the funding and the training and the political direction and spiritual congruency, whereas Syria is more logistical support right now. Now, Syria can play a key role because a lot of the arms that reach Hezbollah do, go through Syria, in my opinion. So, Syria does have leverage in terms of being a choke point to possibly choke off Hezbollah if negotiations proceed in the near term or long term regarding a resolution of the situation.
Hmm. We have a caller here. Let's bring them in on our line number one. They're in Champaign. Hello?
Hello. Yeah. I was wondering, Bush seems to engage in his doublespeak a lot these days, talking about root causes and then saying that the root cause of the problem in Israel right now, or Israel-Lebanon, is the fact that Hezbollah has taken some prisoners. And I'd like you to talk about the root causes as you can. I mean, obviously, you probably don't want to go back to European anti-Semitism that caused Jewish nationalism to develop, and then we have the Zionist movement. But maybe you could talk a little bit more about the root causes. And then I have some other questions.
Well, whatever, respond however you can, Professor Lesh.
If you want to go back to root causes, sure, we can go back to the competing nationalisms of Zionism and Arab nationalism in the early to mid 20th century, and then the creation of the State of Israel, all mixed in with European imperialism, and what developed was this very unstable mix that became enmeshed in inter-Arab politics and superpower Cold War politics, and all of which complicated the situation to the point we're at today. In a more specific sense, with Hezbollah and Israel, one of the things that a lot of people forget, and I know there's a lot of Americans who have a great deal of disdain for Hezbollah, and probably a lot of it is warranted based on the actions Hezbollah has taken against Americans in Lebanon in 1983, or at least they're accused of, with the embassy bombing and, of course, the more infamous bombing of the Marine barracks that killed 241 Marines in October 1983. But we mustn't forget that there was no Hezbollah before Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982 to clear out the PLO from southern Lebanon after PLO-Israeli raids and counter-raids over the years. And, most in Israel, in fact, and most Israeli historians will say that was the biggest strategic mistake in Israeli history was staying on in Lebanon and expanding the war to Beirut, because one of the most amazing pictures I've seen in my career in Middle East history was when the Israelis were moving tanks across the border in June 1982. Shiites in the south, many of whom no doubt are probably members of Hezbollah now, or supporters of Hezbollah, they were putting flowers on Israeli tanks and Israeli armored personnel vehicles and clapping and singing praise as the Israeli soldiers came in, because they saw the PLO as the repressor, as the occupier, and that just invited Israeli reprisals. And so they wanted to get rid of the PLO as much as the Israelis. And the big mistake Israel made at that point was not stopping them and earning and keeping the goodwill of the Shiite population in southern Lebanon. They went on to Beirut, and then they stayed in Lebanon all the way until 2000, and were seen no longer as liberators but as occupiers. And that created Hezbollah. It didn't just form in a vacuum of anti-Israeli activity. There was very little anti-Israeli feeling amongst many of the Shiite population in Lebanon. But it was that situation that developed Hezbollah and, of course, the antagonistic relationship they've had with Israel ever since.
Can you talk a bit more about the meaning of Hezbollah? I know that it literally means the party of God, but
right.
What are their Shiites? And I was just wondering what their religious, political agenda was, how those the religion and the politics intermix. And my understanding was that the Shiites were kind of on the bottom of the social rank, the social level, and the fact that there hadn't been a census in Lebanon for a very long time meant that even though their population had grown, they weren't represented.
Right. Well, you're very well informed. That's exactly correct. I mean, the Shiites, the basic problem in Lebanon on the surface seems to be religious, Muslim versus Christian, or Shiite versus Christian, or Shiite versus Sunni, and so forth. But if you peel away all of that, which has complicated the situation, it's really a question of political legitimacy based on the apportionment of power created, established when Lebanon became independent from the French, because what was established was a confessional system of parliamentary government in which the number of seats held in government and the positions of power are based on the population numbers of, the largest religious sect has the largest block in parliament and has the presidency, and the second largest has the prime minister and the second largest block in parliament. And it was based on a 1932 census that was held by the French that most historians will say was rigged to favor the Christian Maronite population in Lebanon. And the problem in Lebanon is that when it became independent, the Christian Maronite population had the predominant political position, had a very powerful presidency, but they were no longer, they never have officially agreed to a census since that time, because they know that the Shiites now, and for probably at least a generation, have outnumbered, have been the largest sect in Lebanon, and the Sunnis and the Christians about even. And if they had acceded to that census, they would have had to reapportion power and give up all the the political status and economic status that accrues from that political power. So, you know, underneath all of these religious symbols and Arab-Israeli things, which obviously have complicated thing, you know, the situation in Lebanon, it's really a question of political representation and the lack of political representation among the majority of the population, not the majority, but the largest sect in Lebanon, that is the Shiites. And Hezbollah is really a creation of all of that in representing what the caller accurately described as the downtrodden population in Lebanon.
So if the Shia are on the rise in Lebanon and in Iraq, how does this, the Shia versus, say, for example, Al-Qaeda, how do you see, do you see the potential for a civil war extending from Iraq to Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, this type of thing? And that's my last question.
Sure. Certainly there's a lot of talk of enhanced Sunni-Shiite antagonism, not quite the civil war, but you know, obviously, you know, one follows upon the other if things are not resolved. King Abdullah of Jordan gave a speech, I guess, about a year or two ago, where he feared the creation of a Shiite crescent across the Middle East from Lebanon. You know, if where the Shiites are the largest sect, through Syria, where the Alawite sect is ruling Syria, including Bashar al-Assad, and the Alawites are a schism of Shiism that many Shiites only consider to be Shiites, but nonetheless. And then, of course, you have Iraq, where the Shiites have asserted themselves, and then all the way to Iran, which is a Shiite Islamic Republic. And you are tending to see countries such as Jordan, the Sunni-dominated countries, and Saudi Arabia and Egypt express a bit of concern about the assertion of Shiite power in the Middle East, and is one of the reasons why Saudi Arabia and Egypt, at the beginning of this current crisis in Lebanon, actually came out and criticized Hezbollah, which is very unusual for any Arab country to criticize an Arab entity that was taking on Israel. Now, they've backed off from that because they now see that that's an unpopular position in the region and in the Arab street, and that Israel, in their opinion, has really launched a disproportionate response and a lot of suffering in Lebanon. So there's a lot of discussion along these lines, it's something that's very fluid, and you know, we can't predict antagonisms developing across the Middle East along these lines. I think there's more in Sunni Islam and Shiite Islam that's alike than is different, and hopefully that will prevail.
Right. Okay. So. I'm not asking any more questions, but maybe you could discuss whether Hamas is really a non-state actor and whether these things, these Hezbollah and Hamas, have the ability to develop into political wings like the IRA.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Some have made those connections frequently over the years. And if so, can Hamas and Hezbollah be "quote unquote" politically tamed, as what's happened with the IRA? And that was the hope when Hamas was allowed, so to speak, to take control of the Palestinian Authority. And there were indications that there were some splits within Hamas. A moderate group that was willing to work with Mahmoud Abbas and the Fatah faction in the PLO, and possibly, at least indirectly accepting a two-state solution, and then a more radical faction that they were supported by Damascus, that actually apparently carried out the kidnapping of the Israeli soldier as a more of a internal Palestinian play rather than an anti-Israeli one, just to assert their primacy and to disrupt any development toward a more moderate Hamas position, and that's something as well where Syria may have had some influence, because if the more moderate faction in Hamas and the Fatah agree to this two-state solution, and Fatah already has, but if a faction of Hamas does that lessens Damascus's influence with the Palestinian movement as a whole. So there was some hope with that. There was some hope with Hezbollah as well, that you know, with the Israeli withdrawal in 2000, Hezbollah taking a much more political role and charitable role as it has for some time, that they would moderate their position and become everyday players in the political environment in Lebanon and eventually give up their more militant characteristics. And it appears from the recent activities that they have not. But again, you know, I see Hezbollah's move as more of a intra-Lebanese game, a lethal one, obviously, rather than a anti-Israeli one. But obviously, both of the Hamas and Hezbollah making these moves have complicated the Arab-Israeli situation. Not that it was going anywhere anyway. But has the potential of spiraling into something greater.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly makes you think about the fact that whatever the aims, particularly of Israel and of Hezbollah, on the one hand, Israel be concerned about its security in its northern regions, and Hezbollah maybe being interested primarily in enhancing its power within Lebanon. It seems very quickly the situation has gotten out of control, certainly, and maybe not this. We're now at a point where this is not what they had in mind when they started out.
Right.
It's now beyond the. It's almost beyond the point of anybody to get it under control.
Right. I agree with you. And then, in fact, when I met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad a couple of weeks ago, I asked him. I said, "Were you surprised by the Israeli response?" And he said, "Oh yes, very much." They thought it would be the typical, a few barrages and maybe airstrikes, and that would be that. And then there'd be negotiations for maybe a prisoner exchange, which has occurred in the past and under Ariel Sharon of all people. But I think what they didn't foresee and what Hezbollah didn't foresee was this certainly mentality that was growing in Israel that they were under siege, on multiple fronts, because they were, obviously on the Palestinian front with the soldier being taken, and now on the northern front by Hezbollah. And then you have a new government in power with Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and the defense minister, Amir Peretz, who don't have, the military background of Ariel Sharon or Yitzhak Rabin or Benjamin Netanyahu. And they were under a great deal of domestic pressure regarding the kidnapping of the soldier and military readiness and all of this stuff. And I think, part of the response in Lebanon is in part an attempt to reassert their authority, to show that they can take assertive action as well, and also to recreate a deterrent against Hezbollah. And as long as they've received the green light from the United States to try to degrade Hezbollah, they'll go do it, and they have. I think Olmert regrets the statement he made earlier that he won't stop until he destroys Hezbollah, because I don't think that's going to happen. And they have retracted and backtracked from that particular statement. Now they're just looking to degrade Hezbollah sufficiently. And it's almost as if, as you said, that Israel has committed itself, Hezbollah has committed itself, Syria and Iran have committed themselves somewhat. And when you have human decision and frailty involved, what many people think is a contained conflict is not necessarily so contained. It could spiral out of control with one false move or one misperception, and especially when a lot of the particular principles aren't talking to each other. Syria is and Iran are being isolated, and no one from the United States and Israel, at least officially, are talking to these countries, and no one's talking to Hezbollah. And so there's still a lot of a danger of misperception and miscalculation involved.
Let me introduce again our guest, David Lesh. He's professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. That's in San Antonio. He's also the coordinator of the Middle East concentration in the International Studies program there. He is interested in the history of the Middle East, has written a number of books about the Middle East and about U.S. policy in the Middle East. His most recent, which focuses on a major area of interest of his, has to do with Syria. The book is The New Lion of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. It was published by the Yale University Press in 2005. He's also working on a book to be published in 2008, The History of the United States in the Middle East. He's also published many articles in journals in the field and chapters and books, and has been often interviewed on radio and television. Questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Champaign County, I believe, is next. Line number two. Hello.
Thank you. I'd like to open by citing a dissident Israeli author, Tanya Reinhardt, whose book Israel-Palestine is published a while back. She's an academic at Tel Aviv University. You can find her writings there. They're published in Yediot Haronot. She wrote contemporaneously in May of 2000, at the time of the withdrawal, an essay called How Israel Left Lebanon. The takeaway thing for me from the essay, there's a lot of good stuff in it, was that she expected a pretext to be developed to re-enter Lebanon at a later time, that it was mainly just something that was that looked good at the time to pull out, that they felt that she felt that the army was sure that they sooner or later would be able to find some way of getting back in. There's also, I don't have a source for this, but there's a story that as just immediately after the Syrian withdrawal from Lebanon, the Israeli IDF was very interested in going into Lebanon at that time and was sort of restrained by the U.S. From doing it. And then a year later, we have this border incident, which I don't know if you know Edmund Burke III. He's an academic in, I guess, Santa Cruz. He had an essay in the San Francisco Chronicle, which hasn't been much commented on, where he takes the early AP and French sources as saying that the actual initial abduction, whatever you want to call it, capture, was actually at At al-Shab, which is on the Lebanese side of the border. I was looking around trying to find any discussion of this, any information, and there is very little. I thought maybe At al-Shab was part of the Shab farms, which the Hezbollah would regard as some kind of quote-unquote disputed territory, and that maybe the capture happened there. But it doesn't look like that's the case. It looks like this is a different area. There's a fellow named Anders Strindberg who's just written an essay in the Christian Science Monitor, I guess August 1st, where he points out that cross-border excursions by the Israelis were almost a daily thing along that border. So there's I don't know what the substance of it. He doesn't take the argument that it actually happened on the Lebanese side, but I think he would say it's not really important. There were a lot of these things going on cross borders and perhaps on both sides. I'm not sure, but. It's extremely frustrating to hear this whole scenario as if root causes are important, but you know, no root causes existed before July the 12th. That's not a question, but I'd like for some response if you could muster it.
Well, thank you. There's a lot in there, a lot of interesting stuff. Some of which I haven't heard before. I have not read that article regarding the prediction that the Israeli army would IDF would move back into Lebanon after their withdrawal in May 2000. You're correct in asserting that in many ways it was political. Ehud Barak, you know, made it his, you know, one of the centerpieces of his platform when he came to power and. In 99, as Prime Minister of Israel, that they would get out of Lebanon, because obviously by that time it had, you know, become Israel's quote-unquote Vietnam, and the Israeli public was very anxious to get out of Lebanon. The problem with that withdrawal is that the Israelis were desperately hoping, and Barak was desperately hoping, that it would be linked to an agreement with Syria over the Golan Heights, and that's why there was the stepped-up negotiations with Syria in late 1999 and early 2000 that unfortunately did not result in an agreement. They were very close, but for a number of different reasons, and all the parties are to blame, Syria, Israel, U.S. even to a certain degree, it didn't happen. And he was hoping that, you know, by leaving Lebanon and linking it to an agreement with Syria, that
it wouldn't be seen as the Israelis were cutting and running from Lebanon in the face of Hezbollah, and that Syria could be brought on board as an entity that could continue to contain Hezbollah in Lebanon after the Israelis withdraw, because if they didn't, you could forget about, you know, an ultimate and final return of the Golan Heights. And so that, you know, in my mind, that was the big flaw of the unilateral withdrawal in May 2000. Politically, at the time, it was popular and made sense, but it didn't really establish any parameters for maintaining, you know, the security in southern Lebanon. And of course, with the accumulation of events in history, it's tough to link one thing after another. Ultimately, but that was one flaw in that whole process. I think the second thing you mentioned regarding an assertion that after the Syrians withdrew in April 2005, that the Israelis were ready to move in and only the U.S. stopped them. I have not heard that, and I would be shocked if that would be the case. I have not heard that at all. I mean, that's what, you know, the Israelis in some ways, certainly the U.S., have been wanting to get Syria out of Lebanon. On the other hand, maybe the Israelis wouldn't want them back right now because they were the only ones that could really control Lebanon. And maybe that's where some of these assertions or hypotheses develop, in that, you know, since Syria was out of the way in terms of controlling Hezbollah, maybe they would go do it themselves. And maybe in retrospect, that's when some of these contingency plans started to develop in terms of moving into Lebanon, with the anticipation that with Syria out, Hezbollah might start to assert themselves, and you know, whether at the Shebaa farms or at other border areas. I don't have any information regarding where exactly those two Israeli soldiers were taken, but I do agree that you know, there were confrontations between Israelis and Hezbollah that has stepped up a little bit in recent months. It had been fairly quiescent for actually a number of years, and mostly focusing on the Shebaa farms. Certainly from the Hezbollah point of view, you know, taking the Israeli soldiers wasn't necessarily this thing that just came up all of a sudden and we're going to do this, that, and the other thing. I mean, it was in many ways something that was planned for months, and was activated, and was a response to what they felt was, you know, continuing Israeli pressure through other means, and of course their own situation domestically in Lebanon. You know, a lot of things, a confluence of reasons came together, I think, for Hezbollah to make this decision to do that. But I think they probably did not expect the type of Israeli response.
What do you make of this assertion that Syria and Hezbollah and Lebanon somewhat are using Shebaa farms just as a sort of a chip to play to allow them to say that the border isn't resolved? The UN has declared a blue line, but if Syria and Lebanon both agree that the Shebaa farms is Lebanese, I mean, doesn't that take some priority over? But is it historically? I don't know. Historically, there was a lot of interpenetration between Syria and Lebanon. Right. There was a larger Arab Republic in the 50s, right? So, what does that mean? Anything? And one, I thanks for another point. I'm hearing that there's still a lot of confusion inside of the Bush administration about where to go, that the Cheney office and Elliot Abrams, as a representative on the ground in Israel, really want to widen it to include Syria, and that supposedly clearer-thinking people, I guess you might call them, like Condoleezza Rice, say that, well, that's maybe that's not time to do that quite yet or something. I don't know what they say when they disagree. Thanks a lot. It's very frightening.
Yes, it is. Just quick to your first point, I'd like to talk more about your second point. But, yeah, I think certainly Syria and Hezbollah have used the Shebaa farms dispute as a way to maintain this, at least this idea that there's a continuing struggle with Israel, and therefore the Lebanese need the Syrians. Certainly when the Israelis withdrew in May 2000, and there was a there was a groundswell of feeling that grew in Lebanon that they don't need the Syrian troop presence there anymore. And Syria, of course, had many reasons for wanting to stay in Lebanon, not just strategic, but economic and political and so forth. And so they certainly saw the Shebaa Farms as, you know, a reason why they need the Syrian troops there and why Hezbollah should maintain their militia and so forth. So I think that is correct. Yeah, there are a number of splits in the Bush administration, and it's really hampering policy, because what you're getting is not one or the other, but I think something in between. I think this resolution that's been agreed to by the U.S. and France, which will be discussed in the U.N. Security Council in coming days, that is practically worthless. It's so watered down that it is worthless, and the danger is that it gives the impression that there's some sort of diplomatic movement when there really isn't, and some it may give the impression that the crisis has reached its crest and will then peter out after this time, but it's not, and because this resolution just doesn't address many of the issues, and a number of the parties are no way going to agree to it unless it's drastically amended. But there are this whole, and the danger I really see, and I think as reflects this caller's concerns as well, is, you know, this idea, it's resuscitated some, you know, neoconservative views about transforming the Middle East, and to be quite frank and critical of this view, I mean, that it didn't work in Iraq. Maybe we can remake the Middle East through Lebanon and Hezbollah and Syria and Iran. And I hear on various on TV shows and various op-eds and so forth, a number of those that could be seen as supporting somewhat leaning toward the neoconservative view that they should take this opportunity to not only punish Hezbollah but punish Syria and punish Iran, and some have even called for bombing Syrian targets as something of a punitive lesson. And you know, that's obviously, you know, very, very dangerous. There's also attempts by many of these same ideologues to link al-Qaeda with Hezbollah with very flimsy evidence. You know, just because Ayman Zawahiri, the number two in al-Qaeda, expressed support for Hezbollah doesn't mean that they're organically linked. And, you know, sort of the same sort of flimsy evidence that was used to link Saddam Hussein's regime with al-Qaeda, which was used as a pretext for the war in Iraq, it seems to be being employed here, you know, sort of diving headfirst instead of feet first without enough evidence. Not to say that there aren't any or will not be any links between Hezbollah and al-Qaeda, but there's a lot of flimsy evidence being thrown around and a lot of dangerous policy being based on that. And that's when the war, you know, will, you know, when the conflict could widen into a regional war. And the problem is that there are, I think, you know, more moderate elements in the administration, like Condoleezza Rice, who are saying, no, you know, we can't do that sort of thing. We've done it, tried to do it once before. It didn't work. Look where we are. But the problem is instead of, you know, this view of possibly opening even a dialogue with Syria or even Iran, which she pressed, and using that as a way to resolve this situation here, we're not getting that yet, and we're getting something in between, and that what will develop is just a diplomatic stalemate, because the U.S. is neither here nor there.
Yeah. But just real quick to pick up on the point about the potential connection, the possibility of connection between al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, and I have another caller I want to get to. And the earlier caller, the first caller, I think, sort of touched on this. And some of the analysis that I've read, it suggested that al-Qaeda is not real happy about the fact that around the region people are cheering Hezbollah, in part because al-Qaeda are Sunnis and Hezbollah are Shiites, but also because they don't want anybody cheering for somebody else. They would like people to be cheering for them. So they're saying, yay, go al-Qaeda. And they're not real thrilled about the fact that now a lot of people are cheering, yay, go Hezbollah.
Right. Yeah, they want the limelight on them and the conflict in Iraq and so forth. I think that's part of it. I mean, not that Shiite Islamist groups such as Hezbollah cannot cooperate with a Sunni Islamist group. I mean, there is cooperation between Hezbollah and Hamas, which is a faction of the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood. So those things can happen. But each of those groups, Hamas and Hezbollah, really have more localized objectives within their own particular environment in the, you know, the in Palestine or the Palestinian territories and in Lebanon. I mean, they're not really out to create the, you know, the caliphate from, or recreate the Islamic caliphate from Spain to Central Asia as Al-Qaeda is doing. I mean, they are in different wavelengths in many ways. And of course, you know, Al-Qaeda-supported Sunni insurgents are violently enmeshed in a war with Shiite groups in Iraq. And so, you know, you really, at this point, you fail to see how Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah could be organically linked, not to dispel that notion in the future. You know, things change. But again, the fear I have is that certain groups in the administration or ideologues are trying to make that link to reinforce their more assertive policy that they are recommending the administration take vis-a-vis Hezbollah, vis-a-vis Syria, vis-a-vis Iran, that this is a time to really, you know, remake the Middle East in another direction.
Our guest, David Lesh, he's professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, author of a number of books about the history of the Middle East and of American policy in the Middle East. He's particularly interested in Syria, was just there recently. As author, his most recent book is The New Lion of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. We'll go now to our caller, been very patient with us here on line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Professor Lesh, thank you very much for coming.
My pleasure.
I think it's. I want to start with the beginning with something David said. On July 12th, it wasn't just the capture of the Israeli soldiers, which we saw both from the Hamas in the Gaza and also from Lebanon, both crossing over into sovereign Israeli territory. I think it's important that listeners. Remember that for many, many months, both from the Gaza Strip and from Lebanon, Hezbollah and Hamas have been firing hundreds and now thousands of rockets aimed at civilian areas throughout Israel. It's important that the viewers here in central Illinois also recognize that Israel is one-third the size of the state of Illinois. If you take Israel and picture it as from Chicago to Effingham and as wide as Danville to Bloomington, and then you picture it surrounded by hostile neighbor states who are short of Jordan and Egypt committed to your total destruction, I think you have to put that in perspective of what the Israelis are trying to do. I think the Israelis made the effort in 2000 to leave Lebanon, and then we saw what they did in Gaza by leaving there, and instead of it being shown as an opportunity for a peace with their neighbors, the neighbors interpreted it as weakness, and Israel seems to be even more threatened. Even if Israel tomorrow woke up and said that we are going to vacate all the occupied territories, they would not be in a position that they could live in peace because the neighbors are still committed, both Hezbollah and the Palestinian Authority by their charter, to annihilating Israel and trying to push it into the sea. I think we have to look at this as a clear picture between, similar to World War II, between the Israelis in a position where they're fighting literally for their existence and their lives.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think on many levels you're obviously accurately reflecting what many in Israel are viewing. And, you know, as I said earlier, the Israelis certainly, you know, after the situation in Gaza and with Hezbollah taking the two Israeli soldiers, see themselves, you know, being sieged upon. And you know, again, a situation where, you know, that they thought they had long seen in the past, but it seems to be developing again. And I think, you know, again, with the political situation in Israel, there, you know, that's behind this this rather forceful response against Hezbollah, because, as you said, and this is certainly in the Israeli political discourse right now, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. That, as you pointed out, they withdrew from southern Lebanon, and look what you have now, and you withdrew from Gaza, and look what happened. And it seems that Sharon Elmer plan to unilaterally withdraw from the West Bank is probably going to be put on hold because of this, because Israeli body politic is seeing that unilateral withdrawals just don't seem to bring about the peace that people were hoping for. And this might embolden certainly people like Benjamin Netanyahu and others more on the right of center in the political scale. And in Israel, we've been saying all along that this is exactly what's going to happen. Now, Netanyahu has played the good soldier so far and is supporting the government and the forceful response. But, at some point, you could see him and some others coming down on the Sharon Olmert plan on unilateral withdrawal and saying it's not worked. We need to recreate our security boundaries because, as you pointed out, Israel is a tiny country relative to its neighbors and other than Lebanon, and the what's called the Auschwitz corridor in pre-67 Israel, where the West Bank juts in, and it's only about 10-15 miles or kilometers or something across.
That's one
of the reasons why the West Bank was taken, to give Israel some strategic depth. And this is why ultimately these withdrawals and some of the critique of these withdrawals was that they were made unilaterally, that they were not accompanied by peace agreements. And that was the fatal flaw in the unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon in 2000 and, I think, from Gaza. And this is what people were saying early on, that if these are not done through negotiations and peace agreements with the other parties, that they could break down. Because if it's unilateral, it doesn't behold the other party under internationally sanctioned agreements to abide by the negotiations and the agreement. And I think we're seeing that come home to roost right now.
Right. I might add, too, about the Sheba Farms. Mm-hmm. I've read over and over that when the Israelis vacated southern Lebanon to defend their northern cities from their own borders rather than going into Lebanon, the Sheba Farms was recognized as belonging to Syria and mm-hmm. not to Lebanon, and that every single inch of Lebanese territory, as recognized by the United Nations, was vacated by the Israelis. So the Hezbollah, or using the Sheba Farms as a pretext for their fight, is preposterous. I think what we have to recognize is that, similar to the president of Iran, Hezbollah's goal here is the annihilation of Israel as a nation and Jews as a people. And I think we have to maintain that perspective. Mm-hmm. We have the Israel now. I see a correlation between Israel now and Britain in 1941, where America realizes that if they didn't step in then and save Britain, we probably would have been in a heck of a situation in World War II. And Israel is now the canary in the coal mine for the safety of the United States. Mm-hmm. And I fear that so goes Israel, so goes the health of our democracy. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We're coming down to the point here. We don't have very much time. We have a couple of minutes left. To go back to some of your earlier comments about the inadequacy of the United Nations and its effort to try to dampen down this conflict mm-hmm. and get some kind of a ceasefire, and the fact that it seems that very quickly it spiraled out of control of the principles, threatens to perhaps draw in other countries.
The inadequacy of the UN resolution that's being discussed right now, not so much the inadequacy of the United Nations.
Yes. Better a more correct and more accurate way to say it. Apparently the unwillingness of the United States to do anything terribly aggressive. What happens here? Now we're into week number four of the fighting. Lebanon has been heavily damaged. A lot of people have died. The infrastructure has been heavily damaged. Who knows how many years it will take Lebanon to get back to even where it was before the 12th of July. Potential here for wider conflict exists. What's going to happen here?
Well, I think what's going to happen right now, without any more assertive U.S. foreign policy, is just more of the same. And unfortunately, if this, as days and weeks go by, goes to page 2, page 3, and then the back page or the front page, newspapers, then it won't get the attention and therefore the diplomatic attention. And we could get into this situation that occurred in the, you know, the mid to late 80s when Israel held, you know, 15, 18 miles of territory in Lebanon, and then you had Hezbollah attacks and Israeli attacks, Hezbollah reprisals, and back and forth again in this ongoing stalemate and without any resolution to the situation. I mean, I think there's an opportunity here, and this is something I've been advocating in Washington to open a dialogue with Syria, not necessarily Iran, but open a dialogue with Syria, because President Bashar al-Assad, in my mind, that's why he has been associated with this whole thing. How directly, I think, is left to some question, but he certainly sees the opportunity to enhance his position at getting a seat back at the diplomatic table. And my view is, give it to him, because he wants to. He has indicated, and I think is serious about it. He wants to reengage in negotiations with Israel, the Golan Heights, which is ultimately Syria's objective. And he sees Hezbollah as giving them a little bit more diplomatic leverage, which they haven't had in recent years. But the Bush administration, I think, with this, certainly a neoconservative view that has really targeted Syria over the years, doesn't want to talk to them. And I think that's a mistake. I think ultimately there's going to have to be some dialogue between those two that can maybe separate Syria from Iran a little bit and enlarge this issue, not just from Lebanon, but to address some of the larger issues in the Arab-Israeli conflict that will provide the incentive for a number of parties to be more assertive and involve themselves in the way they should have been for many years.
Mm-hmm. And what does Syria want? What I read is what they want is some movement on the issue of the Golan Heights.
Right, exactly. And again, they've been isolated. They've been contained. Bashar al-Assad couldn't even get a visa to attend the UN General Assembly summit last year. He wants to be dealt back into the game. Mm-hmm. Now, the Bush administration, because it's had this inimical attitude, antagonistic attitude towards Syria, knowing that's what he wants, doesn't want to give it to him. Once before, as I wrote in an op-ed article recently, an Arab leader, engaged in dramatic action to try to reactivate diplomacy and improve his bargaining position. This was Anwar Sadat in the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. At the time, the Nixon administration, Henry Kissinger, recognized accurately that that's what he was doing it for, not so much to even gain the Sinai Peninsula back immediately, but certainly not to defeat Israel. And so the U.S. engaged in shuttle diplomacy, and that resulted in the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty in 1979. I think something similar could happen with Syria if we recognize the opportunity.
Yeah. Well, our guest this morning, David Lesh, he's professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio. His most recent book is The New Lion of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad in Modern Syria, Yale University Press, 2005. Professor Lesh, thank you.
My pleasure.